Blog Talk Radio.
Always lots going on. I think, what are we at today? 216th day of the year. I hope you've all got your bucket list ready. Only 4 billion years until the Andromeda comes crashing into our Milky Way. 4 billion years. No time to waste. What do? Create mayhem in the meantime? Spend like we're fiends, like there's no tomorrow? Or live with some degree of dignity? It's interesting when we find this new kind of information out. Does it really make the day any different than it was a week ago or a year ago or 500 years ago? The potential is still there. The great unknown. The things that we don't know that exist around us today. Does that mean that we become wasteful and useless, that we find every flaw in the human imagination and use it to justify our behavior today? I don't know where we are going. If you don't know, here's how it goes. If you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. That's our friend Lewis Carroll said that. The most important thing in life is to learn how to give out love. And to let it come in. Amen to that. That was Maury Schwartz. What can you do when you hear these kind of inevitable quotations? Strange little world we live in. Did you know that the English manager Roy Hodgson is listed in the acknowledgement of Sebastian Falk's novel A Week in December? You didn't know that, did you? Do you know that snowflakes are the size of a red blood cell? But you didn't know that either. Hmm? I'm tuned into this broadcast on Skype. And maybe a few of you have that. Using Skype in Ethiopia carries a 15-year jail sentence. Kind of a rigid, I would say. Did you know that around 400,000 people travel to the United States for medical treatment every year? I didn't know that. Never occurred to me. Did you know that this year's U.S. elections will be the most expensive in history? The total cost of presidential, state, congressional, and municipal campaigns is estimated at $8 billion. That's a serious investment. You know, in Brazil, prisoners can get their sentences reduced by 4 days for every book they read. You've all heard about the footballer, the famous Portuguese footballer Ronaldo. But I bet you didn't know he was named after Ronald Reagan. Talk about being unable to finish and uncertain. Ernest Hemingway wrote 47 alternate endings to A Farewell to Arms. But That was eclipsed by F. Scott Fitzgerald. He wrote 48 endings to The Great Gatsby. Strange little world we live in. Black markets. We all know what the black market is. Trade under the table. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Black markets account for 22.67% of the world gross domestic product. 22.67. Makes me wonder if we need a different way of doing things. Of course we do. We always do. We're always on the lookout for ways of improving our lot, our situation. But there's that and a lot more on the minds of Freemasons. So I want to talk to you this evening. Some of you who have looked, I hope, at the preamble that I put together for the show. I thought that it conveyed a certain appeal to some of you. It certainly made me think as I was writing it up. You know, we've talked in the past about the complications of being in an organization that can look back at its own history. Much easier to run organizations that don't have that. Much easier to run organizations of single purpose. Retailers will probably experience that. People, merchants will probably tell you that. Oh my goodness, the great lament, I know. Everything's apocalyptic. But I would say that for anybody. Whatever they're doing, I think we all feel that nobody really knows the suffering that I've seen because of me. But we all do. We can relate to it in some different way, shape, or form. The show is popular, not really nearly like our Canadian son in the sun, Justin Bieber. He gets like 4 billion hits on social media. Amazing. 4 billion. We do live, of course, in the age of social media. Those who are stuck thinking that we're in the communication era and the era of the internet, I think it's time we explain, catch up. Nothing is waiting, the same as always. Nothing waits. Time waits for no man. Change is occurring around us. This sense of rushing and carrying on, well, it's wonderful because it's communicated faster today than ever before. You know, the inventions of bygone days take months and years to circulate around the earth. It's not that way today. Something happens and not only is it communicated, but the pictures are broadcast to me and you instantly, often before the authorities are informed. I don't know how anybody can say whether that's good or bad. I don't know what kind of frame of reference you'd have, possibly. I want to ask you if you think that we've been part of an order. I want to talk a little bit about Freemasonry, of course, this evening, like we always do. And I'm very optimistic that the heart and soul of Freemasonry is coming back. I don't think it was really widespread, but there's been a need, a curiosity, and a willingness to talk and speculate, to think, to consider, and to ponder. Personally, I don't think this is something that is going to be sorted out sort of top-heavy, you know? You know what I mean? We all sit in rows and listen and somebody pontificates. I think we're getting into the material now where people need to consider and reflect. contemplate. Think about it. This is not 15th century. It's the 21st century. Now, today, we can help form our ideas by using the media around us, books included. There's no exclusion unless there is in your mind. If you think you want to consider that all of what's changing around us means you can't have things the way you prefer, well, of course not. There's all kinds of material around us. But we can also have access to very learned opinions from other people. People who have given things a great deal of thought. That helps us shape our own. We have to admit. We can, I think, easily admit that without a complication. So if we're asking here, are things today different than anywhere else in the world in Masonic terms? Well, of course they are. Of course they are. The challenge faced by Freemasonry is that it's something so unique, so special, that it takes us all a while to even understand what it is that we're participating in. I think. I showed up all dressed and polished and went through different parts of the initiation and then poked my head up and said, well, now what? The question that I don't hear us talking about in our lodges is, so what's this all about? And when I looked around and asked, sort of puzzled and asked the question, I sort of took on this notion that, hey, it must be very deep because nobody's really coming out and giving me any even a semblance of an answer. Not at all, not for years. And yeah, I did ask. Believe me. But did that help? Yeah. So I got the idea that perhaps what I have to do is take this on myself. You know? That this is part of the work. It's the gig. You have to ponder. Well, I didn't want to ask the question, but I really did need to know. Give me a hint. Give me a hint. Show me. Do you mind showing me what chord we're in, or showing me the starting point? Could you do that for me? That would be wonderful. But could I do that? No. So I don't know necessarily if that's a bad thing. But it is what it is. You're left to sort of sort out that. And I don't think this is a bad thing for anybody to try and explain for us the big picture. That sort of universal statement about what it is. Everything in. Now we're seeing people that are doing that. They tend, I think, to find that a lot of us go to the literature, don't we? We go to the literature to try and find an answer to that. We have a lot of very keen, good literature around that will help us with our understanding. It should tell us what it is and what it isn't. I think, you know, you've heard me talk briefly before about our guidelines, our sense of respect for all faiths, all faiths, and we respect the man and his conscience. We assume that men are of good conscience. But you know, tell me here if I'm a bit cynical, but not having that restriction, not getting into politics or discussions around a religion, we never really have to apologize, do we? when things go off the tracks unexpectedly or inadvertently, well, for whatever reason, we, you and me, are not the apologists for that process. We can reflect on it. We can understand it. We can shake our head. We can be confused. But we watch quietly. It leaves us perhaps a sense of, what's the word that I've been using lately? Impartiality. It might not be as much fun as getting into the argument. You know, as I say, that's the salt and pepper on the tedium of life around us. But, you know, the more we know, the more we unravel, the more we want to know, the more secrets that we uncover, answers revealed. So we can say, in a sense, well, we aren't those things. But our organizations seem to have the ability to reinvent themselves. I truly applaud the Grand Lodge. And this is not to detract from those Grand Lodges that are organized in a more central kind of authority. Although we have that, don't we? But we also, it occurred to me that, you know, we seem to have a reflection of the Scottish Lodges, you know, at least in my mythological sense of the independence of the Lodges is well respected, even if even at the expense, bigger picture, we can see the potholes and speed bumps that Lodges are going to face. There's a very cautious, courteous, and circumspect attention to those Lodges. If anyone's to ask for assistance or help or guidance, well, of course it would be there. But the request has to be made. It's like offering help. Volunteering it, you might as well whistle in the wind. It's only useful. Your opinion is truly only useful when somebody asks for it. Good grief, we learned that when we were children. When we learned that we had to tolerate adults that would just carry on with all of their mystifying wisdom. Absolutely useless. Because nobody was listening except the person speaking. We learned that as kids. Oh, we didn't tell our parents that or say that to the adults. We were learning to be polite. Remember? Quiet kids are polite, well-adjusted kids. Boy, did we blow that one up. Now we want to hear what people have to say. We want to hear ideas. It's interesting times we're in. I think we have to recognize the difficulty. I think it would be very hard for lodges to have that sense about them. And for grandmothers, for governance to have that sense of seeing the potential, always seeing the potential. Straining at the bit to try and pull things together and harmonize. It's a massive it's a very, very large undertaking. But I think the beauty of it is that we have that potential always before us, always waiting for us, always pending. You know, we could say if we could only get together and if we could only harmonize, if we could only find some way of agreeing, well, you know, that's where we have to be able to put aside our need to be right, our need to be making the decisions in order to go along with the consensus, even though, and especially though, it does not agree with our point of view. How would you ever do that? I think that's where we get into things like trust. Difficult darn difficult. Darn difficult to do that. But, you know, where do we go from here? Where do we go from here? Expectations are changing. The fine points of our history, we're able to suss out. In some way, it's not agreeing to disagree or anything like that. It's that we have inconsistent information in front of us. The historians are digging in and creating answers. Creating answers where we had questions before, and fascinating. It's not so much changing our opinion. So what are we talking about today? We're talking about eyes in the horizon, huh? Common purpose is not necessarily a single act. I think I remember that I said something like that, didn't I? I think a good society is one in which there is respect for the rule of law, respect of basic human freedoms, opportunity for an individual to live without fearing authority. It's interesting. Where do we go from here? Well, we do it this together. We step into the great unknown, but I think it's going to be more important for us in the future to be able to recognize the talent amongst us. I know you're sitting in your big, comfortable chairs with a great big glass of your favorite Kool-Aid sitting beside you. Now think about this. Let's think about some of the most famous, let's think about Christopher Wren. So we're going to initiate Chris into one of our lodges. And this fellow that we don't know really well, do we, is enormously talented. Enormously talented. Although the government, city planners, people paying the bill could be harshly critical of his abilities because he built and rebuilt. Even in the day, he was criticized. There was efforts to put a stop to the projects because it was overspent. He overbuilt. Who was this fellow? He was out of control. Who's the most highly acclaimed English architect? So let's say that he's walking down the corridor with us today. There's what, 43,000 of us here. And he's one amongst many. I want to believe that we would recognize that talent and ability. I really do. That pure genius. But to do that means that I'm going to have to recognize that he's different. That he talks differently, he sounds differently, he thinks differently. He may not behave like the rest of us. He marches to a different drummer. This is a guy that we know today. He rebuilt 51 churches in the city of London after the Great Fire in 1666. 51. Incredible. He was a member of the Royal Society, wasn't he? And of course, he hung out with our friend Isaac, or Izzy Newton, as we like to call him, and our other buddy Blaise Pascal. Fantastic. Oh, did we mention that? Yeah, he took a lot of heat. But look at, he created St. Paul's Cathedral, huh? My goodness. Yeah, and he built the Royal Navy College in Greenwich and the south front of Hampton Court Palace. Breathtaking. May not like the politics, may not like the symbolism of what it represents, But as a monument to the creativity of man, we stand in awe. Come up with something better. Or just politicize the whole process, I guess. So would we, do you think you and I would recognize that talent today? Shuffling along. Oh, I would, the squeaky wheel, I recognize that. The blowhard, I recognize that. Not that they exist. The ambitious, I recognize that. The sort of the people that are sitting and watching in the wings, claiming that they understand the true nature of everything that goes on. Well, we know those little wags. They're always around. Sycophants, we know. I want to tell you and encourage you to think that we would recognize the genius and the talent, but man, how? How? When he's so different. The likelihood is that it would be so different. I guess you can, you're right, you're right. Dale, why are you talking like this? We have absolutely no need of that kind of ability to source out the talent. What are you really saying, Dale? That some amongst us, that there might be some talent and that we need to be able to see what they've got to say, to see what they can contribute to the big picture? Exactly. That's exactly what I'm saying. Not all of us are Christopher Wren. No offense if you are Chris Wren. Great namesake. But you know the one I'm talking about. The Christopher Wren. Phenomenal. Ah, dear. That's the kind of thing that troubles me. Not that it's about the limits of our craft. Certainly not. This is a struggle for any large group with a history as old as us. It's not to be mocked or laughed at. But we need to be vigilant somehow. I think you'd agree. Maybe we need to put some feelers out. What are we going to do? Say, if you're a genius, just sign here. If you're a genius, but you're foolish in your ways. All the geniuses line up on this side of the lodge. Well, that'll do it. That's already been tried in different forms, hasn't it? You've seen it. Come on, be honest with me. You've seen it. Easy enough to point fingers across the lodge. Find fault. That's the mediocrity of our own backgrounds. Your obligations are aimed at turning you and to redefining you as a man of principle. I think you are. And I think that that's a burden. I think it's a burden. You can argue with me. If everything about our order is wonderful and sunshine and spirited conversation and wonderful camaraderie, then I'm absolutely full of beans, aren't I? But I think it's a burden. Because it changes the way we think. And when we believe something, men of principle have said they go to their grave rather than change, haven't they? Haven't they? What's that say about you and I? It's a tough group, a tough audience. But men of principle are also men of honor, men of dignity. Anyone ever starts to act and sound like they've got all the answers, you probably need to run away. Go back in the cave and look at the shadows on the back of the wall. Not likely to happen that way. But we've been talking in our small groups about these types of things for a long time. What'll happen if and when we use social media to carry on the same kind of conversation? What do you think will happen then? Well, I think a large portion of us will begin to think about these ideas in a different way. if I can do anything for you, it would be to try and hopefully convince you that there is a way of doing this. There is a way for us to think collectively, purposefully. There is. There's a probability that the real talent will fall out of the sky right in front of us. And there's also the probability, while it may be a challenge, that we will recognize the talent, the people that have ideas that will convey us well into the future. Want to know another secret? I do keep wondering, on my bucket list, is the idea of our own Grand Lodge building. With great big doors, marble floors, a deep cavernous theater, well draped. The lodge itself, down below us, with tiers and rows of seating to hold 1,000 men. Lighting that we can control. Sound that we can hear. Acoustics that resonate like an opera house. An architectural style that reflects who we are and our history. Who we are today and our history and the roots of our organization. The work of a single mind. How in the world will we accomplish that? We will. We absolutely will. I'm very hopeful. And when I look around at some of the things going on, I see that we're taking little tiny steps in that direction. Not listening to the whining and complaining. That's always there. We're saying, let's take a look at the end result. Let's use all the resources, not my resources or your resources, all the resources. Do we only use the resources branded Masonic? Come on. 7 billion people in the face of the earth, and we're going to limit ourselves to what, 3 million? Come on. We're bright enough to be able to employ the abilities of this great pool of information that's around us. We can dip into it. We can learn from it, just like we always have. We don't violate any secrets doing that. Not one. How can I violate the secret that you carry inside of your heart and your mind? Why don't you tell the public that the secret is the experiences of what you went through? Why don't you try and explain that? What words would you use? Your own, wouldn't you? And why, oh why, would you ever do that? Because you're trying to convey something special to another human being. Is that so wrong these days? Somebody mocking us, ridiculing our organization. Turn the other cheek and walk away. Somebody belittling us. There's not much we can do about that, is there? Except demonstrate by our behavior how wrong they are. And we turn to that person in principle that was mocking us. And if by chance they happen to need our help, or their child needed our help, you know it would be there. You know darn right. That's what we are. That's who we are. Big doors, entryways for an audience to come in, proper doors for our grandmaster to make his entrance, banquet rooms that are breathtaking, artwork on the walls, a room that makes us feel that we are before greatness, a room that honors 500 years of history, a room that speaks about permanence. If you close your eyes and dream about it, think about what it would feel like walking up the steps, where you know something serious is going on. That is, it's a monument of serious minds from 100 years ago. Oh, did I mention when we get around to finding the genius and watching the mind create something enormously beautiful, that it will be built and finished in 100 years? Oh, you and I will never walk through those doors. I'm sorry. We truly are doing this if we learn how to be self-sacrificing. And my, oh my, can you imagine the whittling down that's going to occur about this idea? Oh, the cost. So much could be done to provide aid for some of our existing projects. Can you imagine? Can you imagine how much pressure and emphasis, effort there's going to be to stop this? Now I think we're getting around to the genius of Christopher Wren. When he was taken to task, as he was many, many times, he had to defend the project. He had to convince the critics that there was great merit in this initiative. And he had to do it repeatedly. And when unexpected adjustments came up, when he was the one that was left and responsible for making changes, when materials didn't arrive on time and he had timelines to meet, and they were for reasons that were beyond his control, he is the one that shouldered that responsibility. We hear him today and think, this was a brilliant man who sat back. What do we want to say? He sat back in this lap of luxury, created designs with his pens and protractors and compasses, and we have what we have today. Well, no. He didn't have one project on the go. He had a lot of projects. This was a man with a mission. His time was running short. Worked like a fiend, didn't he? He left us monuments, statements, expressions of things beautiful. Where is he today? Would we find him? I like to think that we have that ability. I sure do. But probably from an unexpected source. Probably. Sort of those areas where you least expect it. You think, man, that can't be. That guy doesn't dress like a genius. He doesn't look like a genius. He doesn't have genius genes. Gee, he's sort of like us. Well, we can't say that Wren got his gig just walking in off the street. He didn't fall in off the cabbage patch, did he? No. But where do we go with it? Where we go is working together, communicating, talking, keeping our eyes open. Potential's hard to come by, but I think it's about time that we learn to encourage and foster that kind of thinking. Now, can we do that? I think it's really, we're quite able to do that. We have this structure to be able to speak about contentious issues as gentlemen. What it takes is a confidence to reinforce and reinforce the boundary so that when we go overboard, we're taken to task. Hopefully, we're admonished pleasantly. But that the conversation, it never stops. We need to bring out those opposing or different points of view. That's really important. When we are doing that, without losing our temper, we're also supposed to get some control over our desires, get some control over our emotion. Like, we're not children. Temper, temper. we stop making fools of ourselves and each other, we can get into the heart of the matter. Trusting each other enough to be thoughtful. This is where you come in. You know, when you're with your close friends, your friends that you that trust you and you them. That's where we begin to talk about very difficult topics without becoming distracted. It's so easy to become distracted by, you know, misunderstanding or a lack of confidence. It's really hard. It's really hard. So I don't think anyone should say, well, we're in the state we're in because we were trying to make it easy. No, this is really hard. It's a hard, hard task. At times it's daunting. It's a daunting task. In so many ways, Freemasonry embraces these notions and goes even further. A great portion of human history reveals futile efforts to impose a way of thinking, ideas of belief. You know, I'm going to tell you what to believe, and then you're all going to believe it, and we're all going to be fine. I mean, it always, always ends in failure, doesn't it? Every student of history will tell you that. I suppose we could paraphrase Newton's third law of motion and slide it in here. For every action, there is a reaction. Bash away at something long enough, failing every time, and eventually mankind will figure it out. Yep, look where we've gotten. Paid a merciless price to get here. Oh, I know what. We walk around feeling really good about what's happening around us. The cacophony of complaint can often seem to make us believe that that's all that there is out there. Brethren, that's a minority. That's a loud minority. They have a right to that, but that's not what's really going on. What's really going on is we're prevailing. Things are changing for the better. Oh my goodness. I guess I could take out my emotional eraser and say, I don't want to be sentimental about anything. I am. I have the things that I like, but to ever for a moment think I want to freeze time, that would scare the hell out of me. A fool trying to stop time, that's been done. It's been done before. We see people, some of the despots that we're reading in the headlines of newspapers today, trying to do just that. You know, it always ends in pain and failure. And it's always replaced with people that have a more enlightened worldview. Some of our ancestors a long time ago learned that you can kill a man, but you cannot kill his beliefs. It's the power of what we believe that cannot be stopped. Oh my goodness. It's important to be able to believe in the goodness of a fellow man. We say we will. To demonstrate patience when there's failings. To admit our limits. Yeah, I believe people believe what they want to believe. Until it's replaced by something that makes more sense. All that you and I have, I think, is our sincerity and the truth. Be who you are. Always. Don't be faking it. You can dress up like a peacock, but you're not. You're just a fella who's taken some obligations and you're knees are buckling under the weight of them. Science doesn't seem to matter when we're wrapping our brains in uncontrolled emotion. Let me get good and emotional about something, and I can make a pretty good fool of myself. I'm the only one in the order that's doing this, by the way. All the rest are very sound and reasonable. Of course it's fun when we're wrapped in emotion. But it makes us collectively seem like we missed the bus. From the chapters of that famous book, Easier Said Than Done, my copy is well-thumbed. Yours? We begin to influence ideas when we discover new or different ideas. You've got an old idea that's not really working or needs to be polished up a bit. Be innovative. How do you preserve the essence of those old ideas? How do you bring that forward, reinvent it into a contemporary setting? Well, you may not know how to do it, but I'm sure somebody else around you can figure out a way. It's being done every day. Are we that different today than we were 1,000 years ago? We still like a sense of security. So did they. We still need to eat. So did they. A means of protecting ourselves. So did they. Health remedies. These were a little cruder. Some of them were ingenious. So are ours, compared to the way medicine and health will be handled 1,000 years from now. Ours will seem like wizardry. But there's always that sense of progress. When we find ideas that are challenging the status quo, it's important for each of you and me to make those ideas accessible to our friends. And we do that by talking about them. What do you think about this idea? And when somebody blatantly says they just don't agree, instead of just stopping there and walking away, saying, it's easy to ask, do you not agree with anything coming out of that school of thinking, not agree with the whole idea, or is there parts of it that make sense? Now, when you hear people just tossing out, just criticizing really well-thought-out ideas, they do that repeatedly. That should tell you something about the person you're talking to. They're distracted. Their work and their attitude toward change is somewhere else. It's not judging, it's describing. Making ideas accessible is really important. So what do? We often, the answer to that, I think we often put complicated ideas across in a ham-fisted way. And then we throw in a take-it-or-leave-it kind of an attitude. Or even one of my personal favorites, what's wrong? You don't agree with me. Are you stupid? Oh, man. You know, if I did agree with you and you're grinding an idea at me, I couldn't agree with it because it would be humiliating. Or I couldn't even tell if I'm going along with it because of your nasty little attitude. Let your idea, if your idea is so valuable, let it stand on its own merit. It should, shouldn't it? Sometimes I feel like my superiors are acting smug. And sometimes they do. Man, they're sensitive, like I am, about being taken to task for that kind of thing. But remember, you're listening to somebody that can't tell when, you know, somebody has to explain to me when I'm patronizing. It's not that I'm indifferent to that, or it's one of those hard ideas for me to understand. Dale, you're being patronizing. Alright. I always take ownership of it, even when I don't, just because I'm not always clear what it means, what the person say, or whether the person knows. Maybe they're like me. They don't know. They're sort of guessing a bit about what it means. I can truly look each of you in the face here. Yes, look up at your radio, and there you are looking at me in the face. And say that I live in a world of genius, wizards, experts. I haven't a clue compared to you. Everybody around me is a wizard. Everybody has a better right answer for everything. Am I bitter? Absolutely. As the great architect is my witness, not. I get it. Now, what comes to my mind is, so what? Everybody's a wizard. Years ago when I was doing work with children, I realized every child in the eyes of their parents is genius. Has the potential of Copernicus. Except the truth is, we're all normal. We're all average. Some of us are more average than others. Some of us are brilliant. But what in the world is wrong with embracing the sense that we do really well? You think about it, if we're all average, man, we're not bad. Come on. We kick some serious rear end, and we're the average ones. It's the truth. We got it together. We're fraternal order. For a fraternal order, we're pretty average. We happen to be the only one of its kind on the face of the earth. But I think we're a pretty average version of the only one on the face of the earth. And when the next one comes along, we'll have something to compare to. And 500 years of their history later, maybe we won't be so average anymore. Maybe we'll be worse than average or better than average. But I'd say for the kind of uniqueness of us, we're pretty average for an organization that's been around reinventing, an organization of principles, an organization with deep respect for the struggles and commitments of mankind. Yep, I'll speak for myself. I just said you're all brilliant. You're all experts. So I'm the average one of amongst us. The cloistering of a lodge is important because it shields our minds. Why do we use a lodge? What's the health and benefit? It shields our minds. All the pressures and conjecture and criticism don't penetrate that lodge, that atmosphere, that bubble that you and I create. That's why it's really important that you and I are obliged not to let anything interfere with that. And if it does, we need to walk away and go somewhere else. We do as much as we can so that nothing untoward or vulgar penetrates that sanctity. But that's not the task. The task is what it does to our mind, for us. What's it do for our minds, for our thinking? It provides us with an opportunity. That's when the walls can begin to speak to us. When you sit on a sailboat deck, everything has meaning. Everything relates to everything. Whether the light is on or not, whether you're in darkness, bow, stern, rudder, tiller, forestay, we know where it is, port, starboard. We're always oriented, aren't we? Lodge, we're always oriented. East, west, north, south. Depths, heights. The walls speak to us and communicate information. We're not the only organization that has that. I go to a grocery store and there's things hanging off the wall, pouring with information. They're trying to sell me things all the time. I turn on the television and it's full of advertising. It's always pleading with me, trying to convince me to generate a need. I walk into a lodge and nothing there is trying to generate a need. It's like the walls whisper to you and I, hey, have you noticed this? You notice why this is hanging where it is? You ever wonder how this came to be in a lodge? There's a reason, you know. The reason goes back as far as you want to trace it. Hey, those things up in the ceiling. Are they really what's said they are? Sometimes we do tend to overanalyze, gentlemen. Yep. Is there only one way of doing things? Well, our work is always being refreshed and modified. Thank you very much. If we were using the language of 500 years ago, I probably wouldn't have much idea of the meaning. Truly, I wouldn't. And I probably think you wouldn't either. There's words that come into use and go out of use. Masonry opens the mind to new ideas. Absolutely amazing ideas. Because it creates these interesting little environments. But you need to, for each one of us to learn anything, you and I have control over that. Nobody pounds that into our heads. Oh, they can try, but they always fails. Absolutely always fails. Every single time. I'm just going to take a stretch. We'll leave you with a little something. I'm not going to leave you. I'm just going to give you a little something for all the shrine out there. This is a little ditty from 1923. I don't want to hear you fellas springing out of your chairs doing the jitterbug. You can spill your Kool-Aid. This is a tune called The Nobles of the Mystic Shrine. Hard to believe, but it's true. I love this tune. Thank you. bet you that got your Masonic juices flowing, didn't it? 1923, John Philip Sousa and the boys tuned out, cranked out a nice tune for us all to remind ourselves that the Shrine has been around, playfully taking on some very meaningful work for a long, long time. Man, you know, they just even take it for granted that they're helping so many people, so many kids, that I think truly wouldn't have received the help and benefit, the chance that they're given to live a normal life. Beautiful work. I'll tell you, boys, if I don't thank you enough for the effort that you're doing, the number of times you dig in and dig deeper and never fail, then let me say it again. Thank you. Nice work. You make us all look good. And you do it with a little clown smile and some funny cars and always ready for a pat in the back and a good time. Truly amazing fellows. I want to talk to you about the, you know how I'm always worried about whether you're going to be able to handle the young whippersnappers coming up and challenging you. So I've talked with you about some of the little philosophical blurbs. So you know how to handle the young upstart cranking out all that stuff about existentialism, and you know how to do that. Metaphysics. We covered that a while ago. Maybe we'll go over that again. I always like that. I think I love the word. Makes everybody jumpy. What in the hell? What in the heck are we talking about? Metaphysics. Remember, I've sort of tried to live up to a motto from a very, very great man, Groucho Marx, who once said, "These are my principles. And if you don't like them, I have others." So we'll come back to that. But what I want to share with you a little bit is some stuff about discovery. You know, I'm talking about genius and when we recognize it. Well, you know, we live in a complicated little world. Do you mind me talking to you about discovery? And somebody that was on our in our notebooks when we were children was Christopher Columbus. Still okay to go on? What in the world does this have to do with what we're talking about? Has a lot to do with discovery. There's lessons in it. And it really happened. So the history, I'm going to open up the door so we can look at all of the history, not the selected version, not the revisionist, not the history of the apologist. Sort of makes up excuses and rationalizes outcomes to fit what they want politically. Chris was had a single-minded devotion to his enterprise of the Indies, and all the treasure of Ferdinand and Isabella would have counted for naught if Christopher Columbus had not had fair winds and if he had not known how to harness the winds to carry him there and back. All the wealth and all the discovery in the world, he had to be a sailor. The long past age of sail had taken away with it the wonder we should feel for Christopher Columbus's mastery of the winds. Columbus was, of course, grossly mistaken about the continents. He did not really know the lands, but if he did know the sea, which in his time especially meant to know the winds, but if he did, he knew it. At the age of 41, he won the opportunity to try this great enterprise. He already had a wide-ranging seafaring experience behind him. He sailed under the Portuguese flag, and he sailed from above the Arctic Circle nearly to the equator, and from the Aegean westward to the outer Azores. One trip had been in a vessel engaged in trading wool and dried fish and wine between the far north regions of Iceland and Ireland, the Azores and Lisbon. Then for a while, Columbus had lived in Porto Santo in the Madeira Islands, where one of his sons was born. And from there he had sailed and once again commanded voyages to São Jorge de Minha, the flourishing Portuguese trading post in the Gold Coast of the Gulf of Guinea. He varied experience in sailing northern latitudes and encountering all the perils of the sea that would now at last be turned into a single grand purpose. Columbus' own journal recorded that his trip was ordered only after the realm had been cleansed of Jews. Trip over here, eh? In the early morning of August 3rd, the very same tide that carries hapless Jewish people to an old world of persecutions carried Columbus' three vessels from Palos de la Frontera near the mouth of the Rio Tinto toward their unwitting discovery of a new refuge for the persecuted. This was during the expulsion. Remember, we talked about, we came from a time where religious tensions were nasty. And you and I, are, for me, I'll speak for me. My faith paid for what the freedoms that I have in the blood of a lot of innocent people, Catholic and Protestant, a lot of slaughter. I don't know if that's similar to Sunni and Shiite, what's going on with the Muslim faith today. I only hope that they find resolution and peace in their hearts soon. But Ferdinand and Isabella had made August 2nd the deadline for the expulsion of all the Jewish people from Spain. Any who remained thereafter would be executed unless they embraced the Christian faith. Thousands whose only crime was faith in their God were on that very day being crammed into the holds of ships that crowded into the narrow Rio Saltes. Out of the Gulf of Cadiz, they would be shipped to a well-known, unfriendly old Christian world. Some would seek refuge in the Netherlands, others in the more tolerant world of Islam. In the early morning, Chris had to wait because of that day. He had planned to leave on the 2nd, but that was the day that for the expulsion. Kind of a stain on our collective world conscience, and there's lots of them. Instead of setting his course due west from Spain, he sailed first southward to the Canaries, so he would prudently avoid the strong westerly winds of the North Atlantic. And at the Canaries, after his useful week-long shakedown cruise, he turned due west, exploiting the advantages of that season of the northeasterly trade winds, which would carry him direct to his destination. An incidental advantage of this route from Columbus' point of view is that the Canary Islands happen to be on the same parallel of latitude as Cipangu, Japan, the particular destination that he had chosen from his reading of Marco Polo. He could run directly westing, as he said, following his latitude until he reached his desired point in the Indies. It was on the parallel of the Canaries that Orient and Occident were said to be come closest together. For there, the islands of Japan, according to Marco Polo, lay fully 1,500 miles off the east coast of China. Having set the course, he found fair sailing. On the 5th of October, the restless crew was encouraged by flocks of birds flying their way. Then, 33 days out at 2 o'clock in the morning of October 12th, the lookout in the Pinta claimed, "Tierra, tierra, tierra," and he was the first to shout it. The first one, there was a reward. 5,000 maravedi bonus for the man who found it. So, of course, there was a lookout at 2 o'clock in the morning. For the homeward journey, Columbus planned to go north above the horse latitudes to the neighborhood of 35 degrees, where he would meet the westerly trades. That would blow him back. Where Columbus' plan for using the winds was quite correct, the homeward passage was troubled by storms. "The wind bloweth where it listeth," was St. John's way of describing the mystery of that world. "And thou hearest the sound thereof, but canst not tell whence it cometh, and whither it goeth, so is every one that is born of the Spirit." That's from the King James version of the scripture. For the skillful mariner, the Columbus, the winds were the mystery he had to master, just as the steamer's captain must master the machinery of his ocean liner. Same as today. Modern racing yachtsmen agree that a sailing vessel today, after all that has been learned in the past 5 centuries, could not do better than follow Columbus' route. Was his course the product of solid knowledge of the winds or the dictate of a faultless seaman's instinct? Even before he set out, he already had personal experience in the ways of the wind and all the different latitudes where his voyage to the Indies would take him. And so he was well equipped to find the best course out and back. Acolytes of the sea like Samuel Eliot Morison, who's the admiral of the ocean sea, sings the mystique of seamanship prefer to credit Columbus's intuition. We want to give him his just due. So we can be a little bit kinder historically. The discovery of America has overshadowed Columbus' other discoveries, while the passing of the Age of Sail has made it hard for us to appreciate. Even on his first voyage, as another seafaring historian, George E. Nunn, N-U-N-N, reminds us, Columbus really made three momentous discoveries. Besides finding land that Europeans had not found before, he discovered both the best westward sea passage from Europe to North America and the best eastward passage back. Columbus discovered the pathways necessary for ships whose source of energy was the wind. Although he might not have known where he really was going or where he had really arrived, he was a knowledgeable master of the winds, which would make it possible for him to follow, for others to follow him, because he would tell them about the winds. Of course, he had to manage his men, and keeping up the morale of a sailing crew into the unknown was no easy matter. I'd say the things that we have to do within our order sort of pale by comparison to these types of challenges. Passage to the Indies had to be accomplished before the patience of the crew wore thin. At the onset, Columbus promised his men that they would find land when they had gone 750 leagues, or about 2,250 statute miles west of the Canaries. It probably kept a lot of people going. They needed to be assured that they were not going to some point of no return. Yeah, I can see that. We are coming back, Chris, aren't we? Yeah, trust me. I know what I'm doing. Yeah, Chris. Well, we'll take it a day at a time. No worries. We're just going to go out to 750 leagues. We're going to find what we're looking for. We'll be right back. No problem. Play a little football, have a little ale. It'll all be good. And you get well paid. Yeah, Chris, I'm still a little skeptical. No worries. I've done this before lots of times. He was blowing smoke, eh? But he was a good sailor. Then, hey, trust me. I know what I'm doing. I've been all over. I've been up to the Arctic. I've been down to the equator. I'll get you back. Big babies. On the 25th of September, Columbus himself believed that they had sailed a full 21 leagues, but the people were told that 13 was the distance made good, for it was always feigned to them that the distances were less, so that the voyage might not appear so long. This is an old tactic that's still used today. It's like saying, are we there yet? No, we only have another hour. Are we there yet? No, we only have another hour. As it turned out, Columbus was deceiving them less than he intended. He did not realize that his own habit was to overestimate distance. The result was that the phony reckoning he gave out to the crew turned out to be closer to the facts than his own, quote, true journal. Ha ha! Let that learn you, huh? There were more than a few tricky moments during the outward passage, and on the September 21st to the 23rd, for example, when they sailed into the Sargasso Sea, the vast oval area in the mid-south Atlantic, which was blanketed with bright green and yellow sargassum gulfweed, the crew, who had never seen anything like this before, took alarm. Fearing that their ships would be frozen in sargassum, they demanded that the captain change course to find open water. Columbus, of course, plowed straight ahead. Hey, I got to get home. Still today, however, sailors keep alive the superstitious fear of getting stuck in the Sargasso Sea. I love it. We've always done it that way. Even the calm weather, lack of rain, and smooth seas became a cause for grumbling. Whiners, eh? That must have made the trip much more pleasant to be with. Did I say that out loud? If there was no rain, how to replenish the supply of fresh water on the salt ocean? If Columbus was to carry them endlessly westward, as some of the crew feared, perhaps their only hope of seeing their families again would be to toss him overboard. Columbus turned aside complaints with soft words and visions of the Indies' treasures, which all would share. But he also reminded them of the dire consequence for the whole crew should they try to return to Spain without him. On his first outward voyage, Columbus had that most precious additional ingredient, luck. The weather was beyond compare. So, and these are the way he described it, that so that the savor of the mornings was a great delight. The weather was like April in Andalusia. The only thing wanting was to hear the nightingales. Can you imagine on the ocean, perfect sunrise? Absolutely breathtaking. Not the least remarkable, though, the least celebrated of Columbus' achievement was his ability on his later voyages to return to the islands he had first so accidentally and unwittingly encountered. Doubly remarkable, too, because Columbus' navigating techniques were so rudimentary. In Columbus' time, celestial navigation was quite undeveloped. He was unable to use even so elementary an instrument as an astrolabe. Despite romanticized illustrations to the contrary, he probably never saw a crossstaff. Google that. Go and take a look at it. Pretty primitive. He didn't even have that. With his simple quadrant, he was unable to do any useful sighting until he had been ashore at Jamaica for a full year. Only many years after Columbus' death did celestial navigation become normal equipment for the professional European pilot. To set his direction and find his bearings at sea, Columbus depended on dead reckoning. This was a less scientific technique than a practical skill. He used the magnetic compass to fix direction, then estimated distance by guessing the speed at which they were sailing by watching the bubbles, gulf weed, or some other object float by. His estimates were crude, because not until the 16th century did someone invent the chip log to measure speed. Dead reckoning served well enough for going from one known location to another, where the landscape and shoals and currents were familiar. But it gave you no bearings into the unknown. Columbus, we must recall, thought he was traveling to a known destination. Lucky guy? I don't know. Luck and a skilled sailor. A little hard to say it was just coincidence or caprice or serendipity that got him to shore. I don't know if I believe that. What's it going to take for us to prevail and sail across into the great unknown, even though you and I may claim that we know where we're going? So did he. He thought he had a target in mind, and he ended up somewhere else. So the question I want to leave you with this evening is sort of a challenge to the question, how are we going to get there from here? I don't think we can. I think we have to watch the complaining and whining. We have to have some skilled people at the helm with some skills of diplomacy and an ability to motivate and encourage us when we are failing, our courage is failing, to be able to prevail. Not coarsely. To be able to keep in mind the consequences, both of success and of our failure to work together. There's always consequences, of course. You read a little bit with me of the passage of Christopher Columbus, a little different than what we were taught in school. Spain was different then than it is today. It's a common history of mankind. Cruelty, risk. You and I have the pleasure of learning from this history. What does it tell you? Think about all that I've talked about this evening. What does all of it tell you? It speaks to us if we open our eyes and open our ears, open our minds. I think we're capable of it. You can see the potential. If we're skillful, we can turn the luck into a gain, an advantage. But we need to be able to set out with purpose in mind. Maybe tonight my bucket list has grown a little bit. just a little bit more. Maybe it includes something like taking on, talking out loud, making dreams accessible. How do we do that? First, we have to have dreamers. Then we have to stop laughing. And somebody serious-minded has to scratch their head and say, hey, that, you know, might not be such a far-fetched idea. Come up with your own far-fetched ideas and make them reality. We're in an incredibly credible organization, constantly whittling away, constantly innovating, constantly trying to come up with solutions, whether we're talking about major problems or minor ones. For all that we have failings, that's part of the work. We're an industrious bunch. What are we, 3.5 million worker bees at it? Well, we're not all in the same hive, and we looked a little bit different. We're all producing honey. Some more, some less. We're all flying. We're all getting on with the task in mind. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you here this evening. I hope I've offered you the kind of conversation that you've been looking for. I hope you hear some of your own ideas here. Remember, I don't claim to have a shred of it, but independent thought in my head, everything I do is derivative. Of course, you're absolutely right. I lose every argument I've ever been in. If the world is full of geniuses, I'm very, very happy to be in your company. I could do far, far worse. And I certainly know I couldn't do much better. Great bunch of fellows. So this week, I hope you'll go out there and commit massive amounts of random acts of Masonic kindness. I'm going to leave you with another piece by one of our brethren. You're going to know him. His name's George. This was done back in 1924. How can you not love this? Take care of each other. Talk to you soon. To our next program, Reinvention, Particles, Parts, and Performance. Got that coming up on the 9th of August, 8 o'clock in the evening. Hope you'll join me. Ciao, Bella. Thank you.
sensation. Darkness wakes and stirs imagination. Silently the senses abandon their defenses, helpless to resist the notes I write. More I compose the music of the night. Slowly, gently, night unfurls its splendor. Bright, sensed, tremulous and tender. Hearing is believing, music is deceiving. Hard as lightning, soft as candlelight. Dare you trust the music of the night? Close your eyes, for your eyes will only tell the truth. And the truth isn't what you want to see. In the dark, possess you. Open up your mind, let your fantasies unwind. In this darkness which you know you cannot fight, the darkness of the music of the night.